Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, and live from Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, it is the one and only Scarycast on WLSC AM and FM radio, Myrtle Beach, Loris. We're so glad to be with you tonight. We've got our very talented panelists with us. Robin McCray, our queen of Scarycast, she will be back next week. She is actually visiting family in Michigan, and talked with her today. She's having a wonderful time, but boy, she can't wait to get back. So first of all, I will introduce our two panelists tonight. Oh, and by the way, the Amazing Velvet will be back next week. He has got a hall pass for sure for tomorrow. He's got a little procedure to be taken care of, so we're always glad to have him. Our first panelist tonight is the Surgeon General of Scarycast, the one and only Dr. Trey Donaway. How are you doing, Dr. Trey?
Good, John. Happy to be here.
Oh, we're glad for you to be here. And by the way, that article that I sent you is for preparation for a different podcast. So don't worry about not having read it. I thought it was a little bit interesting what I did.
No, I read it. I thought it was excellent. I think it was spot on.
Well, good. Well, we'll talk about that in a week or two. So anyway, thank you for reading that. And we're so glad to have you. And back from his vacation of 2 weeks, the one and only our man from Hollywood, Devin Tate. How are you doing tonight, buddy?
I'm doing great, John. Happy to be back on the West Coast after, you know, a little bit of traveling.
Good. And now, did you get to Kansas?
I did. We were in Kansas for a few days, and we crossed the state pretty much because we had a I don't want to call it a funeral. It's more of a celebration of life for my Aunt Mary, who passed back in March. So that was out in western Kansas. And then we drove out to Kansas City and spent a couple of days there. And then from there, we flew to Boston and took a ferry over to Provincetown. So we stayed there for a while, too. So it was quite the trip. It was good to get away.
Well, that's great, and I am jealous of you being in Boston. I bet you had some of that good Boston brick oven pizza, didn't you?
Well, we weren't in Boston too long, but we did have some chances to eat while we were there, but I didn't get the brick oven pizza. I'll have to do that next time.
Yes, you will. It is really, really good. That's what made me want to go back. So anyway, glad to have you guys here, and I wanted to make an announcement because we've got some great guests coming up on Scarycast. First of all, next week, August 2nd, it's the first Monday of every month, and we have the celebrated paranormal author, John LeMay. He'll be with us on Monday, August the 2nd. We'll be talking about everybody's favorite topic, at least his and mine, UFOs, and probably a little bit of Roswell, too, so it's always a good time. On August 9th, we've got Gabe Trufano. He is actually a friend of my family's. He's an actor. He's in lots of horror films. He's been gashed, slashed, killed, brought back to life, everything. So we're going to have him talking about what it's like being in lots of horror films. He's a great guy, and we're looking forward to having him. And then, of course, on August 17th, we've got Ralph Jarrells. Ralph has been a friend of mine for quite a while. He's written a bunch of historical fiction, and he takes something that's true and embellishes it and creates, he does a lot of research and creates the story behind the story. Ralph and I were talking. Ralph is going to be down here in Myrtle Beach the beginning of September doing an autograph, a book signing, autograph session and everything. And his first book, now if he's very well known for the book about Anne Bonny, the first real lady pirate in the New World. And she was tough, as we said in the mountains, she is tough as wit leather. I mean, you don't want to mess with Anne Bonny. So he's well known for that, but his first book is about the 30 pieces of silver paid to Judas to tell on Jesus and how those 30 pieces of silver made their way to Charleston, South Carolina, to buy a gigantic plantation. And Ralph has done lots of historical research on this. He's a super fascinating guy, and I'm very fortunate that we're going to have him here. We might even have him back when he comes down to Myrtle Beach. But he's just a great guy. He lives up in Charlotte. He's been an advertising executive. He's very well known as a historical fiction writer, but a lot of his historical fiction is based on plenty of facts. So Ralph is going to be just a really cool guy to have. And then we got a very, very special guest from the Travel Channel the next Monday, which is the 24th of August. More about that next week on this station. Anyway, we're so glad to have everybody. We got some real A-listers coming up. A lot of fun here on ScaryCast. And so tonight, we're going to have a very interesting talk on fake news versus real world news. Now, currently, I am writing a book. I always say that, but I am currently writing a book, and I was just told to write the book. And it's called How to Survive a UFO Invasion. A friend of mine, Pat McCray, who is Robin's husband, sent out a text, and it was a little article about it surviving a UFO or surviving an alien invasion. And I thought, well, you know, that's kind of a cool topic. And I went back to look at it, and for some reason, it had been deleted. And I called Pat. He said, oh, I figured nobody would be interested. I was terribly interested in that. Because, you know, we have lots of survivalists, and they're always talking about how to survive a coronal mass ejection coming from the sun that would bring the power grid down for good, and we'd all go back to the Stone Age. But if you think about it, how to survive a UFO invasion is something that might be a little timely. Nobody knows. The government, I'll tell you what, we're going to uncover some interesting facts about how the government has portrayed things that we have better evidence of. So we're going to talk about that tonight, but I think the book is going to be a lot of fun. We are, as my book says, in the first phase of a UFO invasion, because ever since the Roswell crash of approximately July the 7th, 1948, we have had a lot of abductions. We've had a lot of cattle mutilations. We've got well-documented cases. But it's really interesting. I just saw in one of my news feeds today that NASA has gotten together a group of 100 scientists, which means they've gotten together a group of 100 people that don't believe in UFOs and don't believe in alien life and don't believe in anything except keeping their NSF grants. And Dr. Trey, I'm sorry for being so rough on these folks, but I've seen some in action, not all of them like this, but some of them are kind of this way. They're really all about their grant money, and they don't really care what they believe. They just do what they get grants to research. But NASA is coming up with some community standards to make sure that we all adhere to good research about UFOs and life on other planets. And I just cannot wait. This is going to be a hoot and a holler when we've already got plenty of evidence. We've got plenty of first-hand stories. I mean, you know, what more do they want? I mean, you know, whatever. I mean, let's face it. We talked about the flat Earth. That was a little, and I think the word that we used to use in the academic world is specious. It was a little weird, a little funny. Maybe it was right, maybe it was wrong, but it was kind of entertaining to talk about. That's the flat Earth. Now, alien abductions are not fun to talk about. They're scary. They've happened to thousands of people, and thousands upon thousands of cattle have been mutilated. Now, I love the phrase, they've had items surgically removed. And that's the first question I want to ask Dr. Trey. What do you think about the phrase, they've had items surgically removed? What on earth could the press, the untrained, non-medical press, be talking about when they say surgically removed?
Well, you know, I don't know. I don't know why they just don't go in and name the body part that's missing, because they print everything else today. So, you know, if you have an anatomic description of what's been removed, I mean, I doubt if they're going in and doing, you know, thyroidectomies or who knows. I wish they just would name it rather than leave it speculative. And that's what we would do. We just speculate, and we could figure out all sorts of things they could remove. And I don't know any other way to remove something other than surgery, unless you just, you know, bash a leg off with a hammer. I guess you use hammers in surgery, so I guess that would still technically be surgically removed. How else? Magically removed? I'm not sure what they using strange words to make it sound more mysterious. I think they're guilty of that.
Okay, well, what would you use a hammer to remove? I'm curious. That's great. I'd never heard that.
Orthopedic surgeons use hammers all the time because they use chisels too. I mean, basically, it's a lot of orthopedic tools. You could be a wood craftsman as well. I mean, drills and saws and, you know, it's the same stuff because you're working on bones. So whatever you could use on a bone, that's what orthopedic surgeons are going to be doing. And sometimes you use hammers. General surgeons do not use hammers, but orthopedics does.
Okay. I never knew that.
Very
that
expensive
is.
Hammers, I might add. Honestly, I know one orthopedic surgeon, and they have a pair of vice grip pliers, and they use that for grasping things they do not want to let go of. So you can use regular tools in surgery too. I think they're a little cleaner than the ones coming out of your toolbox, but tool's a tool.
I don't know. The ones that came out of my dad's toolbox, he was always careful about polishing those hammers. He really was. But that's neither here nor there. I certainly understand that, and that's interesting. I'd never heard about that. So when they say surgically removed, they could be talking about a hammer and chisel. That's great. Okay. Next. Here's my friend John LeMay. Our friend John LeMay is a wealth of knowledge about the subject of Roswell. Here's what he did for me. I told him that I was absolutely upside down trying to get a copy of the Roswell Daily Record from July the 8th, 1947. It seems as though every copy that's on the Internet, and I mean every copy that is on the Internet, is blurry. It's if you enlarge it, you cannot read anything. If it's the regular size, you cannot read anything. I think that in and of itself is a conspiracy. Well, like a real trooper, John said, "That's all right, I'll just scan you my copy." I said, "What?" He said, "Oh, I've got a copy of it. I got it about 30 years ago, and nobody else got a copy that I know of." So he scanned me a copy, and I transcribed it into text. So for the first time in history, since 1948, I'm going to read to you gentlemen the text of the very, very famous headline and the headline news story from the Roswell Daily Record of what happened that fateful.
Wait a minute, John. When you received it, the government didn't get in there and make it fuzzy so you couldn't read it?
No, they didn't, but I'll tell you what, and I'm being very honest with you. I've sent copies, and Trey, I didn't send one to you, and I didn't send one to Devin or Robin because I figured you guys would be too obvious. But I sent copies of my texting, of the text of what it is, to three friends of mine, one of which is an attorney, and I told all three of them in the instructions to download this off email so that Google won't erase it. And every one of them sent me back an email today and said, yes, I got it downloaded. So I did the best I could. I was really worried. And I also said to all three of them, if all of a sudden you can't get a hold of me, just know that the men in black got here before you did. And,
well, John, this is pretty exciting that you, I mean, please read the paper.
Okay. Devin, are you ready?
Yes, I'm ready. I'm excited.
Okay, so in my book, now this is part of the chapters in my book. It says, now here's what really happened, and here's the real story. July the 8th, 1947, the headline of the Roswell Daily Record, RAAF captures flying saucer on ranch in Roswell region. Subheadline, no details of flying disc are revealed. Roswell hardware man and wife report disc seen. Okay, so here's the story. Yeah, get this. The intelligence officer of the 509th Bombardment Group at Roswell Army Airfield announced at noon today that the field has come into possession of a flying saucer. According to the information received from the department over authority of Major A. Marcel, Jesse Marcel, Major Jesse Marcel, get that. Information from him, an intelligence officer, the disc was recovered on a ranch in the Roswell vicinity after an unidentified rancher had notified Sheriff George Wilcox here that he had found the instrument on his premises. Major Marcel and a detail from his department went to the ranch and recovered the disc, it was stated. After the intelligence officer here had inspected the instrument, that being the wreckage of the flying disc, after he had inspected the instrument, it was flown to higher headquarters. The intelligence officer stated that no details of the saucer's construction or its appearance had been revealed. Now, that's part one of the article. So we have Major General Jesse A. Marcel coming out and saying, we got a flying saucer, and we sent it up farther along the chain. Now, here comes part two, and this is really almost equally as interesting as part one. Mr. and Mrs. Dan Wilmot apparently were the only persons in Roswell who have seen what they thought was a flying disc. They were sitting on their porch at 105 South Pennsylvania Avenue last Wednesday, about 10 minutes before 10 o'clock, when a large glowing object zoomed out of the sky from the southeast, going in a northwesterly direction at a high rate of speed. Wilmot called Mrs. Wilmot's attention to it, and both ran down the yard to watch. It was in sight for less than a minute, perhaps 40 to 50 seconds, Wilmot estimated. Wilmot said that it appeared to him to be about 1,500 feet high in the air and going fast. He estimated between 400 and 500 miles per hour. Now, who knows where that came from, but that's what he estimated. In appearance, it looked like an oval in shape, like two inverted saucers faced mouth to mouth, or like two old-type washbowls placed together in the same fashion. The entire body glowed as though light were glowing from the inside, though not like it were a light from merely underneath. From where he stood, Wilmot said the object looked to be about 5 feet in size, and making allowance for the distance it was from town, he figured it must have been 15 or 20 feet in diameter, though this was just a guess. Wilmot said he heard no sound, but that Mrs. Wilmot said she heard a swishing sound for a very short time. The object came into view from the southeast and disappeared over the treetops in the general vicinity of Six Mile Hill. Wilmot, who is one of the most respected and reliable citizens of the town, kept the story to himself, hoping that someone else would come out and tell about having seen one, but finally today decided he would go ahead and tell about seeing it. The announcement that the RAAF was in possession of one came only a few minutes after Wilmot had decided to release the details of what he and his wife had seen. Now, that is what happened. There is no fake. In 1947, I feel confident that newspaper reporters reported what they were told. Devin, do you agree with that? How do you feel about that statement I just made, that in 1947, newspaper reporters reported what they heard and what they were told?
I would, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I've done a lot of research in old newspapers, and that's pretty much what I found. You know, and a lot of times they're pretty dry and just to the point. You know, that was kind of the journalism style back then.
But in general, well, I think in particular, it was generally the truth. I mean, they reported what they were told, don't you think?
Right. Yes.
There was no agenda. Dr. Trey, how do you feel about that statement that probably in the late 40s and early 50s, journalists reported what they were told? You there, Dr. Trey? Dr. Trey, are you with us? Dr. Trey, are you with
us? Sorry, John. I had muted you.
Oh, my God, you
I'm
muted
sorry.
Me. Okay.
I muted
What do you think about my statement?
Let me start back over again in my moment of silence there. What I said was that I thought the newspaper article would basically be part two. A guy and his wife are on his porch in the summer looking at the sky. Something goes from the southwest, southeast, northwest, and, you know, he describes whatever, and it looked like this or looked like that. It was moving real fast, and that's what he saw. That would be something that a conspiracy theory would arise from. Everyone would claim it was whatever. Yeah, but that would lead to all sorts of speculation and all that, and then the government would come along and they deny it. Then you'd say, well, the government's covering this up and blah, blah, blah. And I could see that happening. But it's part one that is the kicker, because this is an intelligence officer. And did you not say, I mean, what did the man say? We recovered a saucer? What was that? Go back and read that part.
Yes, sir. Okay, yeah, right. I would be glad to go back and say what Major Jesse Martell said. Let's see. Let me find this. It's in a file, so I have to scroll down. Okay. According to information received from the department over authority of Major Jesse A. Marcel, the intelligence officer, the disc was recovered on a ranch in the Roswell vicinity after the unidentified rancher notified Sheriff George Wilcox that he had found the instrument on premises. The intelligence officer of
the
509th Bombardment Group
was,
at Roswell.
The disc was recovered. And
that
this
is correct,
coming
sir.
From an intelligence officer, a major, in the, I'm not sure, the RAA. That's probably Army, Air Force, I don't know, whatever. But it's a military source, and they've just confirmed that a disc was recovered. That tells me a disc was recovered. I mean, do we know anything about this major's career trajectory after he made this public statement? Does he end up going to, like, Nome, Alaska for the rest of his short career? Did he disappear off the face of the earth?
He did not. And I just realized I've got a copy of a book on my table, and I would like for you two gentlemen to talk for a moment, because I've got an amazing book that I found by a colonel that came clean with everything. And I've bookmarked everything so that I could share it with you. And for some reason, I've got to walk away 20 feet. So Devin, you and
okay, you walk
and
Devin
and
I'll...
Devin,
could you imagine if a modern-day intelligence officer came out and made a plain statement of fact that said we've recovered a disc? I mean, I can't imagine that happening today. I mean, it would go up the chain of command, and they'd silence it somewhere along the way.
Right. That's why nobody can speak on the record anymore unless you're, you know, the PR department. You know, they're the only ones who are granted permission, you know, to make the statement after it's been run up the flagpole. So that's why you don't hear a lot of quotes directly attributed to people, you know, about what their job is, because people aren't empowered to speak to the media anymore about, you know, things that they do on the job. From what I've found, you know, even in my company, I work for a nonprofit, and you know, we have one person who is authorized to speak to the media. So even though I may draft some of the language and it may get passed around to other people, then ultimately it's, you know, attributed to one person. So it's gone through a process, it's thought out, it's been vetted, you know, and that's mostly how it goes nowadays. But back then, I think you could just find the person and ask them and they would tell you what was going on.
And it certainly sounds like this guy did that. I mean, I would think that in 1948, the whole army would say, okay, well, we're not going to be doing this anymore. It's got to be filtered through some brass before we let some major go ahead and tell the world what he found.
Yeah, exactly.
That is exactly right. So now it gets a little more murky. The next thing that I'm going to read to you, okay, that newspaper article was dated July the 8th, 1947. I'm going to read you a frightening thing. I'm going to read you what the FBI reported. It's dated the same day. It comes from the director of Secure Air Command that goes to Cincinnati, and it says, urgent, flying disc, information concerning. The 8th Air Force telephonically advised the office that an object purporting to be a flying disc was recovered near Roswell, New Mexico on this date, which is the 8th of July. The disc is hexagonal in shape and was suspended from a balloon by a cable, which balloon was apparently 20 feet in diameter. Somebody, and that was redacted, further advised the object found resembled a high-altitude weather balloon with a radar reflector. That telephonic conversation between the office and Wright Field has not borne out this belief. Disc and balloon are being transported to Wright Field by special plane for examination. Information provided this office because national interest in this case and the fact that the National Broadcasting Company, the Associated Press, and others attempting to break the story of the location of the disc today. Somebody, and it was redacted, advised would request Wright Field to advise Cincinnati office the results of the examination. No further investigation is being conducted. The FBI states that no further investigation is being conducted. That's more frightening than the Kennedy assassination.
It's patently cover up time. I mean, they've concocted something where the first guy was just blurted out what happened, and then they are burying that as fast as they possibly can. If they're
the same
going to take
morning.
A special
now,
plane, if they're going to take a special plane, why would they not do any? What are they going to do? They always send special planes to pick up things they're not going to investigate any further.
Okay, you're preaching to the choir.
We're not
here.
Going to investigate now, this anymore. Okay, you better crack open the special plane to go down in there and pick it up so we can put it into the pile of things we're never going to investigate.
Right.
That's right.
Read between the lines, and they say they're not going to tell you what they find in the investigation. Not that they're not going to investigate it.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So now it gets
even more murky. Are you ready?
Okay.
I called up Barnes & Noble, and I said, "Do you have any books on Roswell?" They said, "We have one. It's called The Day After Roswell by Colonel Philip J. Corso with William Burns." I said, "I want it." I said, "I'll be over there in 30 minutes to get it." And I went and got it. And I paid $21 for this sucker. I started reading it, and I couldn't stop. What happens is Colonel Corso, who this is interesting. His name is not found anywhere on the Internet. But Colonel Corso dictated this story to a very well-known author named William Burns, who lives up in Pennsylvania and is actually the county auditor and a member of the appearance committee of Bucks County or Bucks Township. So I'm on an all-out war to find William Burns because of course Philip Corso's been dead 20 years, and the story that is told in here, just in the first chapter, is terrifying. And it says, okay, can everybody hear me okay?
Yep.
Yep, I can hear you.
Great, because I've got lots of static. I guess the men in black are outside right now. But anyway, Corso says that army people and mean kind of guys went through the entire town and told everybody not to breathe a word of this to anybody, and that one person was even killed about it. You're still there with me.
This is the object that they weren't going to investigate anymore.
That's exactly right. So What I'm trying to do, and I mean they know I'm doing this because I'm calling Bucks Township, and I'm trying to get a phone number for the auditor, who is the co-author of this book, William J. Burns. He is on Twitter. He is the only person who can vouch for the veracity, and I think veracity means the honesty and integrity. Trey, you're my go-to guy. That's
yes,
what veracity means.
You can vouch
right?
for the truth. Yes.
Right, and he is the only person that can say, you know, I interviewed this guy, and he seemed to be telling the truth, because Corso's dead. So I'm going to find William Burns. If I have to drive up to Bucks Township, I'm going to do it.
When was the book published?
The book was okay. I could guess, but I don't want to guess. The copyright is 1997, but this book was published by Simon and Schuster. This book was not published by Pocket Books or the Edgar Casey
right.
Institute. This was published
right.
by Simon and Schuster. I mean, and that tells a little bit about what they thought about, what was thought about this material. It's like, you know, Simon and Schuster doesn't publish junk, do they?
No, they want to make money.
Well, that's true, but I mean, I don't think, you know, they didn't publish Playboy documentaries of playgirls. I mean, they didn't. I mean, they kind of went
no,
after
they would
the hardcore
publish what
newspaper.
They would consider was legitimate.
That's what I think. So if I have to drive, if I have to take off work for 2 days and start up there on a Friday evening and meet this guy, I'm going to find him. I'm going to find William J. Burns. He's still alive, and I'm going to interview him. He doesn't know that. Mr. Burns, if you're listening to this broadcast, I'm coming to talk to you because I feel this is important. And this is the first chapter about stage one UFO attacks, which is, you know, the abduction of humans and the mutilation of cows. And I want to know if you really think that this guy Corso was for real. I want to know if you did. And you can tell me, you know what, Devin, Trey, I want each of you to ask this question. When you're talking to somebody, you can get a general feeling if they're lying or not. Can you, Trey?
Well, yes. Like in the instance of lawyers, if their lips are moving, then you know they're lying.
Okay. All right. But, you know, I think you as an experienced
Yeah, you get you can get the idea whether – now, I think what you get is you can get the idea of the person that's telling you a story if they believe the story, not necessarily if it's a true story. But if they believe it, you'll get that feel, unless they're really
okay.
a good actor and an experienced liar and can, you know – but most people, I mean, when you look at their eyes and you just look at their demeanor and the way they sound, you can kind of figure out if something's hinky or not.
Okay, I agree. Devin, what do you think? Can you kind of fish out a liar?
Yeah, I usually can.
Can.
I mean, although, you know, I live here in L.A., so there's a lot of actors who are very talented at it, but I can usually see through most of them.
Right. And I'll never forget, and Dr. Trey Donaway, I'm going to tell part of a story about our interaction, because I guess back before COVID, when I was coming through your hometown, which we'll leave out of this. We would stop by, and I would have coffee with you. We'd have great times. And I remember saying, you know, I have told you some stories that just seem wild and crazy, but I know they're true. And do you remember what your answer was to me?
No, I don't.
It was the most priceless answer I have ever gotten. You said, well, John, let me tell you a few things. And you told me a few paranormal things that curled my hair. And it let me know that, number one, you kind of believed what I said. And number two, you'd had some interesting experiences, too. So the fact is, I want to know if William Burns, now he does call himself a ufologist. He's got a bachelor's and master's from like Yale. You know, he's a well-educated gentleman. He's done a lot of writing, and he calls himself a ufologist. And I don't know if that really taints what he can say about Colonel Corso or not, but I think he can tell me if he thinks Corso was telling the truth. And I have a feeling that since he spent the time to write this book, he might kind of think it is the truth. So we'll see how that goes. And I'm going to find him within the next month, and I'm going to at least talk to him on the phone because he is alive and well. And I'll let you know what he says. I'll report back on ScaryCast. But
I think it would be interesting to find out, was this his first UFO book? Had he done any
before?
No,
it was not.
Did he do any after?
It was not. He's done about 15.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't have the whole list in front of me, but I went over his bio on Wikipedia, and it's got a list of 15 books. And this one is number one. I mean, because obviously this one's the biggest seller. So, I mean, I don't know what you can say, but it is interesting. And I want to find out what he says, because he's really the only contact we have with another intelligence officer that was in, it was under Jesse Marcel, but who was there and did a lot of investigation, right, because the book is called The Day After Roswell. And so he investigated for about 2 months and had some horror stories about the United States soldiers who yelled and screamed and told people that they hadn't seen anything. So I'm going to find out. I mean, that's kind of my job in this. I'm, as an investigative reporter, I'm going to find out what he says. He's our only connection to Colonel Corso. And, I mean, I don't know. Corso is not listed anywhere else on the internet, other than with UFOs, and you know that they might have been embarrassed and erased his name.
You know, I think what is most astounding to me is the matter of factness that you know, the guy said that that we recovered the saucer, and then the government comes out immediately and says, nothing to see here, folks. Move along. We're not going to investigate anything. I mean, if they wanted a formula to incite conspiracy theories, they just plugged in all the variables and just turned it on, because all that does would incite conspiracy theories and speculation. I mean, it's like a classic example of, if you said, how do we do a conspiracy theory? How to get a conspiracy theory kicked off? Well, you get some poor guy to actually report the truth, and then you deny the hell out of it all over the place and said it's nothing to see. Well, it's going to create a vacuum of people that are trying to figure out, well, wait a minute. And you've given birth to a conspiracy theory that has never gone away. I mean, this is the conspiracy theory that has been going on for 60, 70 years? Easily.
Yes, well, it's interesting. It kind of went away until 1970, until the UFO craze really hit its peak. And then Roswell reared its head. And then the longer it went, the more the Roswell injury festered. And it reached a fever pitch in the mid-90s when the government issued a 1,000, They took 1 year. Now, this is interesting. In 1 year, they created a 997-page report. Now, I want to explain
something
to everybody.
Of the objects that they weren't going to investigate any in the 40s.
Right. So let me explain something that I know about. I know about conducting research. I wrote my doctoral dissertation of 300 pages. It took me, because I worked on it full-time, a year and a half. So if someone worked on research like this, it would have taken 4.5 years to create that report. It didn't happen in a year. I mean, all they did was, I would surmise, is they got folks to write some fiction. Now, I'm going to ask Ralph Jarrells this week about how long does it take him to write fiction, because I think he's a pretty fast writer. And I think probably if you did 3 months' worth of investigation and threw a couple of writers at it, you could probably finish that 1,000-page report in a year. I do. So, I mean, it's like, come on. Just before you even look at it, it would take too long to research that to produce a 1,000-page document and proofread it and get it proofed by everybody. It couldn't be done. If it was really researched, it couldn't be done. And that's just – now, that is from experience. That is something that I know. It took me – if I was doing a research paper for a conference, a standard 10-page paper, it would take me 2 months to do it. Multiply that to 1,000 pages. Come on. So, first of all,
so really, what you're describing is you're describing the rate-limiting step in creation of a paper, a research paper.
That's exactly right.
It's something that the process itself requires time, and even if you had a team approach, it would still take an inordinate amount of time in order to actually create a research.
Right, now I have a copy of it in PDF form.
Degree it needs to be.
And now I've got to download it, I've got to print it out, and I've got to read this thing. Because I can guarantee you I might be the first person that's actually read this document. And I've read it, and I'll read it with a critical eye, and I'm going to see what mistakes that I can find. Because now I can read pretty fast. I can read research fast, and this doesn't have any scientific formula, so I'll be okay on that. So I'm going to let everybody know what I find. But the whole point is, this couldn't be done that quickly. And and that's the first point. It's rate limiting. That's a perfect phrase, and I've never heard that. I learn a lot from you, Trey. So that's the whole point. It takes, hey, Devin, you write music, don't you?
I do.
It can take you anywhere from a couple of hours to a couple months to write 5 minutes worth of music, right?
Well, yeah, and I tell you, I have not written anything for over a year and a half now because I just haven't had any, haven't had that spark, haven't had that motivation or that inspiration. So, yeah, it can take even longer than that.
The spark, the motivation, and the inspiration. I mean, you know, what did they do? Just hire a team of writers and said, come up with it. You know, here's the outline. Just write it. We'll proof it, and then we'll just put it out. And, I mean, that's about what they did. They had to do. And I'm going to read the whole thing. I'll be the first person to read the whole thing, 990 pages. So I can't wait. I can't wait to see what kind of stuff is in it. And I'm just coming from it from that approach. So we'll see what happens. And this is just chapter 2 of my book. And, you know, I mean, I think it's interesting. I've become very interested in Roswell for reasons other than most people. The fact is, there is so much cover up there. I have an interview with a Roswell native about how Roswell has progressed from 48 up until now. And there are a lot of people they just kind of forgot about everything because somebody put the squelch on this. They kind of forgot about it. Then here came 1970 and the UFO craze. And that's what really started it. And then by 1990, they've got the UFO festival, and everybody's laughing about it. So Some people think it's stupid. Some people think it's silly, and that's fine. But we will see what we will see. And so this book has become a little bit of a different task than it started. It's not only how to survive a UFO invasion, which, I mean, I thought was kind of an interesting topic, but it's also about, is this real? And it's going to have some real research, and real documents are going to be gone through. And so that's what we're going to do, we meaning me. If I can get somebody else on the team, I'd be glad to have them. But I think it's going to be fun. And I think at this point in my life, I want to do fun research. If it's not fun, I don't want to do it. But I'm getting very interested in Roswell for the reason – I mean, there's a – Devin, you're the man that's up on this. Isn't there a TV show called Roswell, New Mexico now?
There, you know, I think there's a – there was one that I watched back in the early 2000s, and I believe it has been rebooted or however you say that. You know, I think it's been brought back, and I believe it's currently airing. I haven't seen the new – the current version, but I did watch the entire run of the original one.
Well, what did you gather? What did they portray about this incident?
Well, the thing I thought that was interesting about it was, you know, it's obviously a fictional TV show, but the premise was that when the spacecraft landed, or crash-landed, rather, in Roswell, that there were actually survivors of it, and that some of those survivors then took on human form and continued living in the Roswell area.
Okay. The real
story.
So they
just relocated to Roswell intergalactically.
Exactly. And so in the show there was, I believe there was like three of the aliens that, you know, were basically living as teenagers. I think they were, you know, in the show the premise was they were like some sort of unhatched egg when they landed. So they developed and grew up as humans, but they at some point became aware of the fact that they were from somewhere else, and then there was a plan for them to go back to that planet, but then there were other evil aliens who were trying to prevent that. So it was really interesting, and it also was thought-provoking because it's, you know, it could, you know, it's not that far out of the realm of possibility, right? Like, it's very possible that if there's visitors to this planet that made it here, that they have some way to stick around and monitor it, you know?
Right. Well, I mean, I can tell you that I came from Burke County, and that's as alien as it gets.
I would think there are a lot of places where an alien could blend into the general population, but I don't think it would be Roswell. I can think of places on the coast that would, you know, people wouldn't even look twice at you. They just think you've been to a really cool body piercing or tattoo shop and had some really bizarre things done, and they just wouldn't give you a second look.
Right.
Just go to Burke County, North Carolina. Yeah, exactly. And But the real story that comes from Colonel Corso is that one or two of the aliens were still moving and were alive and were taken to the Roswell base, and then we don't know anything more about them. And
they probably put on a special aircraft that'll never be examined again or investigated. John, actually, just again, it's the flat-out statement by the intelligence officer that they recovered the saucer without further explanation. I mean, if he had said, "Yeah, we recovered the saucer. It was attached to a weather balloon. We don't know what it is. Somebody's goofing around." But he didn't say that. He said we recovered the saucer, and that was it. And it was up to the FBI later on to throw in the weather balloon element and the obfuscation and the confusion that came out of those statements. I mean, it's when you read the series of events as described in a newspaper and then the government's reaction to it, it's pretty transparent that, well, that's something they don't want the world to know about.
Well,
oops.
Well, now, and what's interesting is there is a publicity picture in this book the day after Roswell, of Major Marcel hanging out and with elements of a weather balloon, you know, and just looking at it and, you know, come on. I mean, that is the most, I mean, that's as staged as a third grade play. Come on.
Yeah, so some guy saying, quick, bring in the weather balloon, you know, drape the weather balloon
rip
over
it up
that rock over there.
Let's have a picture.
Yeah. A weather balloon, and, indeed.
That's exactly right. So anyway, that's my tome on fake news. I mean, that's the first of the real fake news stories, and it comes directly from an FBI report, oh, urgent, going to Cincinnati. And it makes no sense. None of it makes sense. And I guess I'm as I say in my opinion piece of the five stages of a UFO of UFOs coming, the first stage happened with Roswell, because that's when the world woke up that golly, something must have happened. I mean, they didn't wake up in Aurora, the great story of Aurora, Texas, in 1897, that John LeMay and Noe Torres talked about. And by the way, I'm gonna, if it's all right with you guys, I'm gonna have John LeMay continue our discussion, because he is a native of Roswell, and the boy knows what's going on there in Roswell. And I'm gonna say, talk about things that won't get you abducted by the men in black. So I'm going to ask him if he'll do that. And then the next month we'll have Noe Torres, which is when we had John LeMay and Noe Torres, that is the highest rated scary cast in history. Over 300 people listened at this point. I mean, people have gone crazy. Noe Torres is a famous, famous man. He's a librarian in Texas at a middle school, and he's one of the greatest UFO writers in the world right now. And I can't believe that, you know, John LeMay, this is the package that John LeMay comes from. You know, he comes with Noe Torres, and he comes with over 30 books, and he comes with a great book on Jaws. And he's just, he's been such a pleasure. He helps me every time he can. He's just a great guy, and that's why I like having him on. I'm so grateful that we have him once a month. So we'll have him next week. But so we've got fake news at its finest, and that's one thing that I want to talk about. And I can't wait to try to find William Burns. If I have to go find him, I will before our next show. I mean, it's just amazing that there's actually someone that knew this Colonel Corso and can first of all tell me if this was a real person. I mean, there's nothing online, but that doesn't surprise me. There's nothing online that even says anything about Colonel Corso's career. It just talks about him being basically a UFO geek. So, I mean, what do? We just, you know what we do? I guess we keep investigating. Dr. Trey, when you're a surgeon, you just keep on working with a patient until you can hopefully fix them. Is that correct? You just keep
or until on. Anesthesia says we got to wake him back up.
Okay. All right. Whatever
until it's lunchtime, you know, and you go, well, we do have to have lunch eventually here, you know, so let's just put it back together as best as we can, and we'll see how, and we'll just see how things go for a while.
Trey, okay, Devin, I know that, you know, you're an accomplished musician, you're an accomplished comedian, and you have a good job, and you just have to keep at it until it works, correct?
Yep.
Whatever it is.
Sometimes it's easy. Sometimes it's, you know, you do it 100 times if you have to.
Well, you know, while you were talking about rate limiting steps, and when you work, there is a minimum time. Even if you're like a flaming genius and you're driven by inspiration, and of course, I always think Handel, in writing his Messiah, wrote that in a record-breaking time. Well, do you know how long it took him to write the Messiah, and he was using recycled material. But still, it's considered a record-breaking time, and everyone says it must be, you know, inspired writing. But it still took the man 23 days to do this. So it's not like he sat down for the weekend and cranked out the Messiah. You just, even if you're inspired, there is only so much you can produce over a period of time. And when you look at that as the rate limiting factor, there is a rate limiting factor. It's just the capacity to work. And there's a limit to it.
Yep.
There is a capacity to work. You're 100% right. So I think we've got some good things to talk about next week. The Queen of Scary Cast, Robin McRae, will be back with us. Amazing Velvet will be with us. The whole crowd will be here, and we're gonna have a blast.
I would really be interested to get John LeMay's take on just that first article and then the second one, because in between there's, and then the third one where the FBI their decision that nothing's to be seen here. I mean, that's a pivotal moment in the evolution of that story, which is an obvious setup for conspiracy theories, because the facts seem to be vacated by the time the FBI got a hold of it. Amazing, amazing, amazing. But there you have it. It's very apparent how this created a 70-year-old conspiracy theory. And I guess in this most recent report, where the government was coming clean about UFOs and all this stuff, how many mentions do you think they gave of old Roswell?
Zero. And I'll have that next time, because they said there are five things. It could be a UFO. It could not be a UFO. It could be something that we know about. It could be an enemy object, and then something, or it could be nothing. And I mean, that's what they say in this 9-page report. The biggest nothing burger of all time. And I'll have that on the website
they didn't
for
have
everybody
it.
To see.
I presume they didn't have anything about Roswell, because they already told us they weren't going to investigate it anymore, right?
Oh, they
after
have nothing
the special
about
airplane
Roswell.
Came and picked it up. Yeah. Well, they already said back in the 40s that they weren't going to investigate that anymore. So I guess they didn't. I wonder where the special airplane dropped off the package.
Well, John, you've heard,
you know,
the
it could have been lost in some. It could be stuck in some warehouse, and people just said, oh, "What's that? Oh, that was something we got from Roswell a long time ago. We don't know what's in there. You know, could have sold it at a yard
sale." It's like the end of the first Indiana Jones movie. It's like there's this whole big raft of boxes, and there it is. Says Roswell. You know, that's what you got. Yes,
yeah.
Evan, what were you saying?
Well, I was just going to say there's the new theory that UFOs are just actually billionaires from other planets.
Well, maybe.
I like that. Did you read about the petition they had? People signed. They don't want to let the billionaire back to Earth. They want to keep him in space.
I'd sign that petition.
Oh my goodness!
This is a great scary cast you did tonight by reading the fairly straightforward factual material that got twisted and more bizarre as time went on, and as it went up the command chain to the people that would put a lid on all this. Fascinating.
And I hope that in a month, well, actually, by next week, I hope I have some news about William Burns. I mean, maybe not. Maybe his phone will get disconnected. Who knows? I mean, I've got a friend that I talk about ghost stuff with, and all of a sudden, his Facebook is gone. His phone doesn't work. His mother's phone doesn't work. I don't know what. I mean, I hope they all didn't die up there in Kentucky. He's been on ScaryCast a couple of times. I don't want to mention his name, but I mean, it's like, I hope I'm not bad news for everybody. But anyway, we will see. We've got the man, John LeMay, who can talk to us about this very topic, and I'll ask him if he minds doing it because it's such a great one. We'll have Robin in the Amazing Velvet. We'll be five strong next week with some of the best co-hosts and reporters. And Devin, will you bring the music next week like you did this week?
Sure thing.
Thank you very much. It's been wonderful. Look, this has been, as usual, it's been such a fun ScaryCast on WLSC AM and FM Myrtle Beach, Loras, on the World Wide Web, on TigerRadio.com. Thanks to everybody. My co-hosts have been the most fun in the world. They're such good friends, too, and it's great when you can work with friends. And when I get my other two best friends on, it's nothing but a party for me. So thanks, everybody, for being on ScaryCast. Thanks to all of our listeners. And we will see you next week, same bat time, same bat channel, 9 p.m. Eastern time on Monday night on the World Wide Web at ScaryCast. And we'll get some more listeners, and I think we'll have a blast. So, Trey and Devin, thank you so much. We'll see you next week, okay?
Yep. Good night.
Good night, John. Thank you.
Take care.